government degree college in two South Kashmir districts. So I think this summer is going to be very tricky.
Last month, India and Pakistan agreed to abide by the 2003 ceasefire agreement along the de facto borders dividing Kashmir. However, the crackdown by security forces and attacks by militants continue unabated. Kashmir has been a bone of contention between India and Pakistan since their independence from the British rule in 1947. The two countries have fought wars over the region and claimed sovereignty over it. After witnessing decades of violence, people in Kashmir aim to see a peaceful future. Majority of people living here believe global powers need to play their part before the animosity between India and Pakistan claims more lives here. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Minister, Kashmir.
The U.S. and Iran will go back to the negotiating table in Vienna to talk about the nuclear deal. The U.S. State Department made this bombshell announcement on Friday, and it's now the talk of the town. But a high-ranking source in Iran says that Tehran has no such a plan before Washington lifts all sanctions against Iran. Since Biden took office, Iran has made it clear that it is the U.S. that should return to the nuclear deal first, as it was the one that unilaterally and illegally withdrew from the agreement. This stance is shared by Iranian lawmakers as well.
Our leader has put the final word on it. No talks with the U.S. until all sanctions are lifted. After Iran made sure that all of the illegal sanctions are no longer in place, then we would return to our commitments.
There is no point in negotiating to the U.S. while it was the one that broke the international rules and withdrew from the accord. We retaliated by scaling back some of our obligations to the deal, and that's based on Article 35 and 36 of the JCPOA. We have not violated anything.
Senior officials from all signatories to the nuclear deal, namely Iran, France, Germany, the UK, Russia and China, will gather in the Austrian capital on Tuesday to discuss ways to salvage the ailing accord. The Biden administration is also sending a team of experts to Vienna. Washington hopes to talk to the Iranian representatives over a step-by-step timetable that would bring both sides to compliance with the accord.
And the primary issues that will be discussed are the nuclear steps that Iran would need to take in order to return to compliance with the JCPOA.
There's no step-by-step plan, says Tehran. Iranian officials say the aim of the Vienna session would be to rapidly finalize the removal of all sanctions and nothing else.
Iran will not accept any step-by-step proposal. We think that there will be just one step, lifting all the sanctions. After the verification, Iran will come back to its commitment.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled the U.S. out of the accord in 2018 and reinstated sanctions against Iran. Tehran responded by ramping up its enrichment of uranium and limiting international monitoring of its nuclear sites. Meanwhile, Biden has indicated that he's willing to clean up his predecessor's mess, but has taken no practical steps to do so. Observers say any headway should be made before Iran's presidential elections in June, which could lead to the formation of a new Iranian negotiating team and more delays.
So the bottom line is, there will be no direct or indirect talks between Iran and the U.S. in Vienna or anywhere else. Iran says any return by the U.S. to the nuclear deal will not need any negotiations. Once it's in the deal, Iran will reverse all its remedial steps and will go back to full compliance. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Most government hospitals have remained largely empty because of a nationwide strike action by resident doctors who constitute a large percentage of medical doctors in government hospitals in Nigeria. Consultancy rooms have remained empty because of the absence of medical doctors to attend to patients. Doctors' union officials said they are tired of the government failing to live up to its promises of settling their salaries and other benefits on time. Representatives of the Nigerian government met with labor leaders behind closed doors in a last-minute effort to avert the strike, but apparently the meeting ended in a deadlock. The government appealed to the doctors to consider the damage their withdrawal of services will cause to Nigeria's health system. But the resident doctors said the government should keep its several promises. This strike is coming at a challenging period, especially with the COVID-19 pandemic, with only about 800,000 Nigerians vaccinated in a country with a population of close to 200 million. Nigeria has 163,000 COVID-19 cases, out of which 2,038 people have died so far. The doctors' union said all the resident doctors at the COVID-19 centers have joined the strike and withdrew their services. This doctor's strike is in progress just when the Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari is receiving treatment in a London hospital. According to union officials, close to 16,000 resident doctors are participating in this strike, which is indefinite. Most of the resident doctors are specialists who provide important healthcare services, especially in emergency wards. Benjamin Abdullahi, Abuja.
Iran and the other signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, held virtual talks on Friday to discuss the fate of the agreement. During the meeting attended by China, Russia, France, Germany, and Britain, along with Iran, the signatories agreed to hold in-person talks in Vienna on Tuesday. That will be part of the meetings of the Joint Commission of the Nuclear Deal. Later, White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki claimed there will be indirect talks with Iran in Vienna.
These talks will be structured around working groups that the EU is going to form with the remaining partners in the JCPOA, including Iran. And the primary issues that will be discussed are the nuclear steps that Iran would need to take in order to return to compliance with the JCPOA, and the sanctions relief steps the United States would need to take in order to return to compliance.
Tehran will hold no direct or indirect talks with Washington before it removes all anti-Iranian sanctions.
According to the immutable guidelines set out by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, any outcome of the joint JCPOA commission meeting, which is based on the notion of step-by-step removal of sanctions, is unacceptable. According to the guidelines by the leader, the Islamic Republic will only return to its JCPOA commitments after the removal of all U.S. sanctions and Iran's verification of the move. The Islamic Republic will not hold any mediated or unmediated talks with the U.S. before all sanctions are lifted. Just as the U.S. left the 2015 nuclear deal without negotiations and imposed sanctions on Iran, it should now remove all sanctions without talks.
Iran signed into the 2015 nuclear deal and committed itself to limiting its civilian nuclear program in exchange for removal of all nuclear-related sanctions against the country. That was meant to ensure Iran benefits economically from the accord, but those benefits were scarce and fully evaporated after the former U.S. administration withdrew from the agreement in 2018 and imposed unilateral sanctions against Iran. Analysts say all Iran is saying is that a once-negotiated deal does not need to be renegotiated.
The deal was the result of negotiations. So the negotiations have already taken place. The deal tells all sides what they're supposed to do. So the Americans know exactly what they're supposed to do. There's nothing to negotiate. If they want the deal to work, they have to implement it. But if they want to take bits and pieces and think that they can gain concessions from Iran, Iran is not going to do that.
Almost 3 months into the Biden administration, Washington is yet to right Donald Trump's wrongs on the nuclear deal. Tehran is clearly seeing through Washington's empty rhetoric and is calling for action. On Friday, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi told a virtual meeting on the nuclear deal that the remedial measures Iran took after the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear deal are reversible, but only after the removal of all anti-Iran sanctions and its verification by Tehran.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Senator Ron Wyden, the Oregon Democrat in charge of writing tax legislation, released a new plan on Monday, 5th of April, to overhaul the way the United States taxes multinational corporations in what could be a blueprint for how lawmakers will finance President Joe Biden's infrastructure plan. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jim Tankersley and Alan Rappaport. The piece is titled, Democrats Prepare Plan to Raise Taxes on Multinational Corporations. Senator Ron Wyden, the Oregon Democrat in charge of writing tax legislation, released a new plan on Monday, 5th of April, to overhaul the way the United States taxes multinational corporations in what could be a blueprint for how lawmakers will finance President Joe Biden's infrastructure plan. The proposal could raise hundreds of billions of dollars from companies that operate across international borders, according to analyses of similar proposals by congressional schoolkeepers. Senators Sherrod Brown of Ohio and Mark Warner of Virginia, both Democrats, signed on as co-authors. In addition to raising revenue, the plan seeks to discourage companies from shifting profits and jobs to low-tax countries to avoid paying taxes in the United States. It also creates new incentives through the tax code for companies to invest in research and manufacturing in the United States. The proposal would tweak several aspects of President Donald J. Trump's signature 2017 tax law, which created a series of new mechanisms for how the United States taxes multinational companies. It would increase the rate of a global minimum tax that was included in that legislation and change how it is applied to income that corporations earn in various countries overseas. It would also alter two other parts of the 2017 law in ways that the senators say would better encourage investment in America. Those measures mirror the Biden administration's ambitions on international taxation. Separately, on Monday, 5th of April, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen called for global coordination on an international tax rate that would apply to multinational corporations regardless of where they locate their headquarters. Such a global tax could help prevent the type of race to the bottom that has been underway, according to Janet Yellen, referring to countries trying to outdo one another by lowering tax rates in order to attract businesses. Competitiveness is about more than how U.S.-headquartered companies fare against other companies in global merger and acquisition bids, Janet Yellen said. It's about making sure that governments have stable tax systems that raise sufficient revenue to invest in essential public goods and respond to crises, and that all citizens fairly share the burden of financing government. Just last week, President Joe Biden proposed spending $2 trillion on an infrastructure package financed over 15 years by higher corporate taxes. That includes raising the corporate tax rate to 28% from current 21% and a variety of changes to international tax rates. On Monday, President Biden continued to press for those tax increases, saying that companies need to pay their fair share and that there was no evidence behind concerns from Republicans that raising tax rates would drive investment out of the United States. We're talking about companies in the Fortune 500 that haven't paid a single penny in tax for 3 years. Come on, man, Joe Biden said. The president is expected to detail as much as $2 trillion more in education, healthcare, and other spending initiatives later this month, much of which would be financed by raising taxes on high-earning individuals. Joe Biden's aides have estimated that his international tax proposals could raise more than $600 billion over the course of the next 10 years. Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, in a news release, said the senator's tax plan would not only generate critical revenue to pay for President Biden's infrastructure package, but would also encourage additional investment in the United States and its workers. The Senate drafters do not specify the exact new taxes associated with their plan or how much additional tax revenue it would raise, choosing instead to wait and set rates to match Democrats' spending ambitions later this year. I'm going to start rolling out specific proposals so that people can have ideas about how they might proceed, Senator Ron Wyden said in an interview last month. The presence of Senator Sherrod Brown, one of the most progressive Democrats in the Senate on tax issues, and the more centrist Senator Mark Warner as co-authors, suggest that Wyden's plan could attract widespread support in a Democratic caucus that most likely cannot afford to lose a single vote for President Biden's infrastructure plan. Senator Sherrod Brown said in a statement on the plan that corporations should pay their fair share of tax, just like Ohio families do, and they shouldn't get a tax break for shipping workers' jobs overseas. Senator Mark Warner of Virginia argued that the proposal would provide an incentive to invest in the United States, saying, "We need an international tax system that rewards companies making investment here in the U.S., particularly in cutting-edge technologies that will dictate the future success of our economy and the ability to create more jobs."
America.
Part 2.
The question of who rules America has been debated throughout America's own history. It was originally raised and answered to some degree by the American Revolution in the 1770s that fought for independence from the British Crown so that Americans, at least some Americans, could rule themselves, or at least they hoped they could.
We're at Columbia University with Dr. Eric Foner, a historian and writer and teacher here at the university for a long, long period of time.
I think what is unusual today is two things. One, the degree of inequality. Never before has the very, very top, the 1%, had so much of the national income and wealth in its own hands. And, you know, so that the gap is greater than ever before. And secondly, you know, Occupy Wall Street is not primarily a movement of farmers, of laborers. It doesn't have the same base. People need to learn history. That's part of our job, to know that this issue has been around for a long time. There is nothing un-American about raising the question of economic plutocracy, economic inequality. It's as American as apple pie. And, you know, I think that the Occupy Wall Street people are you know, legitimate heirs of a long and venerable tradition in this country. You know, many revolutions start at the top. In other words, the people who began the struggle against Great Britain were merchants in Boston and New York, plantation owners in Virginia. You know, most of the founders in Virginia are slave owners. But what happens is, as the struggle intensifies, they have to generate support among ordinary people. And when you do that, you break open the political system and you open the door for very, very different kinds of demands. Slaves start demanding their own freedom. Women, Native Americans, start demanding greater equality. So what happens at the beginning when a more privileged class begins the resistance, that doesn't necessarily tell you how the whole process is going to take place.
This conflict between the 1%, actually the 0.001%, and the 99% had its echoes here in the home of America's anti-colonial uprising, in the back streets of Boston, where a freedom trail today commemorates a massacre by the British and a fight for liberty. And that's where we'll take you next. Was the American Revolution really a revolution?
The British thought it was a revolution, no question about that. It was not a social upheaval in the way, let us say, the French Revolution was, but it certainly overthrew an entire system of government. It replaced the ruling class with another one, so that seems to be what a revolution is about. And it raised these questions of equality in the society, not just equality in terms of 1% and 99%, but the role of slavery in American life, the status of women in American life. It unleashed a kind of struggle for equality among all sorts of groups, which continued long after the revolution was over.
Listen, my children, and you shall hear of the Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. That's one of the most famous poems of the American Revolution. And here we are in front of the statue of Paul Revere, the man who alerted all of Massachusetts to the British troops coming into their communities. We're on the Freedom Trail in Boston, where the American Revolution is remembered. Well, what kind of a revolution was it? What actually happened here in Boston back in the 1700s? What have we learned since then?
Thousands of tourists and students visit these revolutionary monuments every day, but most have only a foggy idea of what really happened and tend to repeat the mythologies that are taught in their schools.
Here was Paul Revere. Paul Revere was one of the great revolutionary heroes. Are you kids here to see the statue of Paul Revere?
Yes, we are.
Yes. Can I ask you a question about it?
Sure.
We're
sure.
Doing a little TV program here.
Yeah.
Who was Paul Revere? What was this all about? Do you know?
He was a founding father. Ride.
Yeah. Yeah. Midnight Ride.
To warn about the British for coming.
Did you know that he was a very rich businessman, a silversmith here in Boston, and that he wanted to be in the Continental Army and they wouldn't let him in? Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Did you know that in Boston there was this merchant class, you know, business leaders, the 1%, who were really running the whole show? In many ways, and that the people were not as involved because back then there were slaves, there were indentured servants, there were a lot of people who didn't have a say in what was going on. Did you know about that?
No idea. I didn't know anything about Paul Revere.
We would love to learn from
you. I'm supposed to learn about it in history, but I don't think it's
my brother Bill here has taught history to students in Massachusetts for many, many, many years and has followed, you know, the various debates about our history. What was it about this revolution? You know, was it a popular uprising, or was it sort of led by elites here in Boston?
Well, both were true. There were popular elements. Ordinary people did resent the British. Ordinary people did participate in riots and boycotts. But there was a 1% back then. The leaders of the revolution both led it and channeled it. They were certainly not above using words like liberty and freedom to deflect and distract people from their own discontents in the colonies.
And their own interests. I mean, the business class of Boston didn't want more taxes on their products. They wanted to compete with the British goods. They felt they shouldn't be taxed. And as a result, there was the original Tea Party here in Boston.
And there were, merchants like John Hancock, who was into smuggling goods. And you're right, they didn't want to pay British taxes. I mean, there were other factors behind the revolution as well. But when this revolution was codified in 1787 at the Constitutional Convention, the people who were invited were the large landowners, the slave owners, the merchant class, no women, no Indians, no blacks, no working people.
Actually, there were slaves that were inspired by the revolution to try to get their freedom. Some actually did.
I think the idea of the revolution and the idea of democracy were radical, inspiring, revolutionary, in ways that actually might have made the leaders uncomfortable, since some of them themselves owned slaves. They really didn't want this to go viral in the way it did around the world.
So who ruled America then? Mm-hmm. In a way, their grandchildren are ruling it today.
And sometimes direct descendants of those people. So, there was a certain amount of class mobility. Indentured servitude disintegrated due to the chaos of the revolution. But I don't think the people who led the revolution really intended a social revolution. That was really not what they were thinking about. After the revolution, people like Daniel Shays in Western Massachusetts, a farmer, a captain in the revolution, did try to inspire, organize another rebellion against those who he saw as replacing his British masters. This time, they were the colonial leaders.
So here we are, 225 years after the Shays Rebellion rocked Western Massachusetts in a challenge to the 1% of those times. We have a memorial for Daniel Shays and the men who fought with him. And what's interesting is we have American flags being put, in a sense, almost at his tombstone here, marking support for the values and the aspirations that he fought for.
My name is Dave Rothstein. We're at the Stagecoach Tavern in Western Massachusetts, town of Sheffield. And this painting is a painting of Daniel Shays, militiamen. Daniel Shays fought in the revolution. They came back from the revolution and found their farms being foreclosed and many put in prison because of the same debt crisis that we're experiencing now. There are many similarities, but essentially, one of the promises of the revolution was to annul the farm debt. And the farmers came home and discovered the debt was even greater and the banks were even tougher.
Today, the Shays Rebellion is mostly forgotten, but it lives on YouTube with songs and dramatic recreations.
Shays now unsheathed his sword and ordered the fife and drum players to strike up a tune. The men began marching in cadence.
The irony, says historian Eric Foner, is that Shays was just a front man for a mass movement.
In fact, it was the opponents who said it's Shays' rebellion in order to find a kind of boogeyman, they could attack. So let's forget about Shays as a person and think about the mass movement, the farmers, the ordinary laborers who took to the streets, shut down the courts, and said, wait a minute, we had a revolution. We have installed a government that's supposed to represent the people here in Massachusetts, and yet it's talking, it's the bankers and the landowners and the merchants who are getting the benefit of everything.
It was the first Occupy Wall Street movement. They petitioned the government in Boston for redress, and the government ignored the petitions. And they're having still had their arms, they went to these court sites and picketed to prevent the courts from sitting. Succeeded to some extent until private militias were formed and the Massachusetts militias were formed to suppress it.
It was suppressed right near here, right?
The last battle was fought in Sheffield. It was led by Brigadier Ashley, who's the Ashley House is still here. And Colonel Ashley, his parents, were one of the heroes of the revolution. So here we have the same family
building independence, but then trying to suppress it.
If many white Americans were disappointed by the achievements of the American Revolution, what about blacks and Native Americans?
In 1730, when Sheffield was incorporated, there were 30 black families in Sheffield. Half were slaves, half were free. But the famous story is, again, at the Ashley House, one of the servants, Elizabeth Freeman, called Ma Betts, overheard all the talk about the Massachusetts Declaration of Independence at the dining table. And it occurred to her that maybe she might qualify. And she actually filed in the court of Great Barrington and won her freedom. So here you have the court giving freedom on one hand and suppressing freedom on the other.
Years later, a small black community in the area that Daniel Shays made famous became the home of a young man who had become a leader of the fight for civil rights. He coupled concerns for racial equality with demands for economic justice. Today, in the center of his hometown of Great Barrington, Massachusetts, there's a wall mural celebrating his political and intellectual contributions. It includes quotes from President Barack Obama and Martin Luther King. Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois.
Du Bois was one of the giants of the 20th century, although, of course, he's born in the 19th century. Du Bois put forward the issues which are still with us, the race issue in America. You know, he said, 1903, the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. It's still a problem in this country and around the world. Du Bois talked about economic equality and how to gain that, and he grappled with these questions. He's a brilliant writer, a brilliant thinker, and much of what he said is still relevant, I think, to thinking about American society.
What about Native Americans?
They were the ones to be eliminated because it was their land that was wanted, not even their labor.
Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz is part of America's indigenous movements and says the people we call Indians were being exterminated. We asked her about the American Revolution.
It wasn't a revolution. It was a war of independence from the colonial overpower. But it wasn't an anti-colonial revolution like the Bolivarian revolutions in South America or the Haitian Revolution.
So there are many different, even competing narratives about the origins of the United States.
The United States, of course, was founded as a settler state, as a colonial state, became an imperialist power. And the democracy has always been an oligarchic democracy, a capitalist democracy with a rhetoric of populism, which is so strongly based on race. That is, if you're not black, if you're not a slave, you're not indigenous. If you're white and a settler, then everyone can be a king, everyone can own land and be a landlord. So all these peasants who came as settlers, the dream is to be, be the king of the hill. And so it's a very insidious kind of democracy because it's an illusion.
Illusion or not, this is a subject that needs to be examined if we are to understand who rules America, the origins of the 1%, and then teach about it.
So this is all part of the history that most Americans probably don't know. Did you find when you were teaching students here that many of them just didn't know much about their own history?
I think there are many students that I taught in one of the towns that fought at Concord who were never even in the spot we're standing in now. I think that's true, that many kids were not familiar with that history, beyond local battlefields and so on.
The other thing about the Revolutionary War, which is relevant to today because we live in a globalized world, is that this revolution started locally here in Boston, but soon the British were involved, the Dutch, the French. Mm-hmm. It became a war of many different countries all fighting on American soil.
Well, very true. And the French intervention was very critical to our success. It wasn't all through the force and valor of our arms. There were other people involved. But I think the idea itself has played a revolutionary role in history. But the idea itself did not create a deep social revolution in the United States. And to this day, people are distracted by words like liberty and freedom and justice in the same way that they were back then.
Ironically, the original Tea Party, which inspired the modern right-wing Tea Party movement today, was actually a protest against an earlier form of corporate imperialism.
Why was tea the issue, not corn or whiskey or something like that? It was because the East India Company had gone bankrupt in China, and the crown, the British crown, bailed them out so they wouldn't, you know, lose their assets. But then the crown looked around and said, well, what does the company have that we can sell? Well, it turned out what they had was tea. So they decided to market the tea. And that's why it was tea that was the taxed issue. So here you have a big financial failure, and it was global. The implications rippled across the Pacific, rippled across the Atlantic, and we have the Boston Tea Party.
Throughout our history, there have been sort of conspiracy theories about all of this. I mean, today, for example, both the right and the left seems to see the Federal Reserve Bank as sort of a conspiracy concocted in 1913 without any proper process and kind of running the show.
Yeah, well, you know, conspiracy theories, conspiracy thinking is deeply embedded in our political culture. My PhD supervisor, my mentor, Richard Hofstadter, wrote the famous book in the 1960s, The Paranoid Style in American Politics, in which he traced out various kinds of conspiratorial thinking, whether it was Catholics who were in the before the Civil War trying to undermine America, or you know, various other groups at various times, immigrants, others trying to, you know, destroy the American culture, or the Trilateral Commission, remember them in the 1970s, was supposedly ruling the whole world. Now the Federal Reserve, right, if we only abolished the Federal Reserve Bank, everything would go back to some utopia of the past.
Throughout U.S. history, you see various right-wing movements point out scapegoats in the society, and they're usually the folks who are already marginalized in some way or another. And what happens is that there comes a moment when it becomes really useful for the elite powers, whether they're in government or corporations, to encourage these movements. So you get a Tea Party, or you get a militia movement like in the 90s, or you get the Ku Klux Klan in the 1800s. And what this is all about is taking angry, mostly white people who are mostly somewhat privileged and convincing them that they're about to fall down the social economic ladder.
Now, I guess the basic problem with conspiracy theories is that no group can fully determine what happens. Even people with great power launch things, and then they kind of lose control of them, and things happen in a way that is unpredictable.
When you look back at history, and you maybe can see, because of, you know, it's a long time ago, all of these forces. Mm-hmm. Yet today, somehow, in the news, we never see these forces. What we see are politicians spouting various, you know, rhetoric and speeches, but we don't really know whose interests they're serving, who's behind the scenes.
Well, this is why we need research. We need an understanding of who rules America. Because the mythology today is that it is the people who rule America. And most folks don't know a great deal in terms of specifics about the role that corporations play, the way politicians are tied to corporate interests.
Change is possible. I think when one talks about who rules America and a power elite, one should not use that to simply fall into a kind of quietism and say, well, nothing is possible, no change is possible, everything's under control. Many of the major popular movements in our history have been big surprises. You know, nobody expected them to come. And I think the same thing with Occupy Wall Street. Nobody expected Occupy Wall Street to come up simply out of nowhere. And so I think, we have seen that over and over again in our history, and we will continue to.
And now the ball of history has been passed to a new generation, fighting to transform a large and complex country with many power centers. But just as in the past, it is determined minorities who make the difference. An elite made the American Revolution, and as we will see, a power elite still rules. last episode of Who Rules America, how the military and the corporations took over.
The people who rule America are the large corporate entities, which are supranational. They have no loyalty to the nation state.
Next time on Who Rules America.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Over the last 2 years, Islamophobia, something the current British Prime Minister Boris Johnson himself has been accused of, anti-black systematic racism evidenced with the Windrush scandal, and anti-immigrant sentiment have continually surfaced and arguably grown amid a general working climate of hostility in Britain, in the street, within right-wing movements and political policy, at the heart of the government's hostile environment. I prepare for you an article written by Richard Sudan. The piece is titled UK Government-Backed Report Claiming British Racism in Decline Ironically Demonstrates Opposite. Please stay with us for more of Richard Sudan's article. Slavery denying, deeply racist, and gaslighting. These are the terms you would expect to hear if people were to describe sections of Britain's racist right-wing media. But incredibly, a British government-backed report into racial disparities concluding the country is not institutionally racist has been slammed by experts and commentators alike with those very same descriptions. The long-awaited finding recently published by the Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities claimed to present a new race agenda for the country. But in reality, for many, the so-called research has simply green-lighted racism itself, whilst denying the lived experience of those facing serious prejudice. Coming under fire from academics, experts, activists, and campaigners alike, as well as MPs, the overarching consensus is that the report is simply not worth the paper it's written on. Furthermore, for critics and long-time anti-racism activists, it amounts to a deeply insulting piece of propaganda and slap in the face from a government and prime minister that have faced continued accusations of racism. The commission chairman, Tony Sewell, wrote in the report that a new narrative needed to be told about the period of slavery that wasn't just focused on profit and suffering. Given Britain's profiteering from the slave trade and also that the ongoing and unresolved Windrush scandal is scarcely mentioned in a report arguing Britain has taken big strides in alleviating racism, people are rightly outraged. Racism in Britain is as serious as it's ever been in recent decades. Calling the report divisive, as plenty have done, seems a huge understatement. Stoking the flames of existing tensions might seem more accurate, because this report will likely serve as fuel for the apologists of deep-rooted racism. Number 10 Downing Street backed the investigation into racism in Britain, following pressure after a wave of Black Lives Matter protests last year around the country sparked fresh and renewed debates around racism and systemic inequality, leading to demands for the government to take decisive action. Many feel the hugely opposed policing bill currently being pushed by the government is designed in part to prevent the impact of any such future protests, following the momentous and nationwide numbers of people who took to the streets in 2020. But the government's report has been furiously rubbished as whitewashing, downplaying and dismissing the lethal, brutal and traumatic legacy of slavery, of which Britain played a leading role. And the reality of modern racism in Britain couldn't be clearer. Over the last few years, Islamophobia, something Prime Minister Boris Johnson himself has been accused of, anti-black systematic racism evidenced with the Windrush scandal, and anti-immigrant sentiment have continually surfaced and arguably grown amid a general growing climate of hostility in Britain, in the street, within right-wing movements and political policy at the heart of government's hostile environment. Disparities in housing, disparities in healthcare and health inequality, employment and policing are all very clear. And this reality at odds with the government-backed findings is what has infuriated people. Indeed, tellingly, in the hours following the report's publication, Prime Minister Boris Johnson's most senior black advisor, Samuel Kasumu, quit the government. And incredibly, two academics said that they were named as stakeholders in the commission's report without their consent, whilst also disagreeing with the findings of the report. Stephen Byrne, a historian on black British history, said he was misled about his name appearing on the government's botched report, labelling it flawed. S.I. Martin, a black author, said it was a gross insult to see his name added to the report, explaining that the commission had not contacted him in any way, shape or form. The list of criticisms is long and varied. Simon Woolley, former chair of Number 10's Race Disparity Unit, and founder of the Operation Black Vote, described the report as a truly historic denial of the scale of race inequality in Britain, delivered precisely at a moment in our national history when the opposite is required. Lee Jasper, an anti-racism campaigner with decades of experience, wrote a damning indictment of the report, making the point, which resonates with so many non-white people in Britain, that systematic racism is a literal life and death issue for our communities. It's hard to overstate the scale of the outrage that this government-backed report has produced. Racist attacks have rocketed in numbers in recent years, particularly around the Brexit vote. Racism in policing and deaths in custody, which disproportionately affect black communities, remain areas of deep concern and ultimately neglect by the authorities and obvious examples of the very institutional racism which the government suggests is no longer a blight on Britain. And in recent days, it came to light that a Metropolitan Police officer had also had membership in a banned neo-Nazi group. These are just some of the realities which fly in the face and question the government's self-congratulating report. But perhaps none of this should be surprising. Prime Minister Boris Johnson in the past has described Muslim women as looking like letterboxes. He has also described black people as having watermelon smiles and as pickaninnies. He once said Britain's colonial role in Africa, that the problem was not that Britain had been in charge, but that Britain was no longer in charge. All of this, of course, chimes perfectly with how the report into racial disparities in Britain has been interpreted. Not only is it not worth the paper it's written on, but far from providing evidence that racism has lessened in Britain, the very report itself, in essence, ironically shows the opposite. That deeply embedded structural racism is very much alive and rampant in Britain as ever.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Whose Streets, directed by Saba Folayan and Damon Davis. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Lee Jasper, who is a former policing director for London and a social justice campaigner. He is also a Black Fox sponsor, which was formed in 2015 as a result of events concerning the increasing levels of violence impacting London's black communities. Now, Whose Streets is an unflinching look at the Ferguson uprising in the U.S. state of Missouri. The uprising sparked nationwide protests the day after the fatal shooting of Michael Brown by white police officer Darren Wilson on August 9, 2014. Now, filmed on the front line of the clashes, this documentary captures the explosions, the tear gas, and the military-style police vehicles up close. And at the same time, the film also manages to show the anger and sense of outrage that the heavy-handed response provoked.
Anybody growing up here, you tangibly know when you cross the county line, you got to drive a little differently. Your behavior changes because you know how policing changes.
First, police just killed a man in front of my apartment.
People flooded in the area have some experience with police.
Things have never been right for black folks in America.
We're trying to mourn, and you came here with 300 cop cars right here in canine units.
You gonna shoot me too?
But that ain't the story that you hear about.
This is chemical warfare that you are not supposed to be able to use on U.S. soil.
This movement was born in love.
We are raising activists. If there's going to be any change, it starts with our children.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary provides a really great insight into the racial tensions of the black community in Ferguson and the police and the issue of police brutality is brought up. And we also get incredible access of the residents themselves to express their struggle from their point of view. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Whose Streets?
The film is very specifically about Ferguson. It's not a general film about policing in America or Black Lives Matter or any of the bigger issues. It's very, very specifically about Ferguson. It does obviously touch on much bigger issues as a result. So it feels like a really important document, but it's not as easy to watch as a film. It doesn't have a central narrative line. It has a lot of great characters in it, people that it explores. But the thing that makes it really, really worth watching is the footage in it. It's full of incredibly shot footage on people's phones and their own private cameras. Right on the streets in the middle of all of these riots and all of the tensions and the back and forth of everything going on. So it's showing us a side of the story that the media never showed, because the media kind of took a very slanted view of this whole thing. And
the documentary highlights this.
The documentary contrasts the footage that was shot in the streets with what the media showed the public, and that's very interesting. And I think that makes the film definitely worth seeing.
So as Richard was saying, it is an incredibly big topic, lots of layers, especially on this issue of racism, police brutality, and American gun violence, and so forth. Luke, if I could turn to you now, what's your take on these sorts of films, and why are they important?
I think it's an important part of documentation of the struggle of ordinary communities against excessive police violence and institutionalized racism, and that part, it formed an essential documentary narrative. around detailing their particular stories from a human perspective. Each individual family is looked at and goes into some detail. So it really gives you the full 3D picture of what a community under pressure from police racism and violence looks like, feels like, smells like, how they respond personally, how it affects their personal lives and the communities around them. And for that, I think it's an important part of social documentary.
But as Rich was saying, this documentary largely focuses on Ferguson. But as we know, the African-American community have been plagued by police brutality for decades. But what is it that made the Ferguson uprising so different?
I think it's a combination of things, really. I think that by the time 2014 comes along and the impact on new technology, on people's understanding of justice and struggle, and the extent to which we now see people capturing inappropriate policing incidents on their own mobile phones, gives this a unique feel because it's from 1,001 different perspectives. If anything, this film is almost like a people's film made up of huge numbers of individual filmmakers who captured various scenes and they tried to knit it together in the way that has been described. So I think new technology, I think Hands Up, Don't Shoot, and the Black Lives Matter all emanated from it. I think people were tired of an Obama rhetoric which was about equality but seemed very little in terms of holding police to be accountable at a local level. And the images themselves were so deeply resonant of the black experience and the African-American experience in the United States as to sort of re-excite an embryonic civil rights movement. The scenes we saw on black and white and colour pictures of police brutality and victims in Ferguson in 2014 could have been Ferguson 1964, yeah. And that was the power of their message.
And the power of relevance today, exactly. Rich, so one observer in the documentary calls the clash between the police and the black community a quote, unseen war. And it's been reported that $11 million was reportedly spent on law enforcement connected to the Ferguson uprising. Do you think the film is successful in showing how aggressive the policing is?
I think it really does. I mean, on the one side, it shows how these people just come to the street just saying, how can you shoot an unarmed teenager 10 times? How can the police do this and then try to pretend like it's not an issue? And then the police respond to them coming out into the street with, I mean, what you saw in the clip was, they're all standing in a line looking really menacing. But later on, they come out with full riot gear and dogs and, snipers on the top of these giant tanks that are rolling into the street. It's pretty terrifying because the police just reacted as if the public, who are just desperately crying out saying, don't treat us like this. The police are reacting as if they're the villains. The general public are the villains. And the film really captures that sense that these people just feel desperate and they don't really have a choice but to riot. They start off with a quiet vigil. It's a candlelight vigil. And their voices get louder and louder and louder because nobody's listening to them. And the police are responding like that.
As it said in the film also, that Martin Luther King is quoted as saying, the riot is the way, an act of showing the protest of the unheard. Now, Lee, what do you think of the militarization of the police? Is this an appropriate response to deal with the situation?
Well, it's not in a liberal democracy, in supposedly, the land of the free. I think what we're seeing all over the world, really, in Western democracies, is increasing militarization. And in fact, most Western police services are almost following a sort of Israeli policing model. That seems to be the standard model, to be very heavily militarized, and to have the option of using overwhelming and overpowering force. The policing that we saw in Ferguson was akin to an invasion by a small army of a foreign occupying force seeking to invade another country. The combatants' language was the same, the imagery was the same, and I think it's a very dangerous precedent when the police force, and that's what it is, a force, can militarize itself using the advanced latest equipment available to them of any military in the world for use against civilians.
And it's exactly the point that you raised that actually, because in the film we see an American Palestinian resident of Ferguson, and he used to live in the West Bank, and he said it's no different, the West Bank and Ferguson, in the way they're being treated. Do you think that's a fair point to make?
I think it is a fair point. I think if you look